We're going to find out what the bread of heaven is as we look at this passage and ask the question, somewhat related to the question we asked last week, how does the Lord get his people to trust him? How does the Lord get his people to trust him? And the simple answer actually is by giving them no option. God gets his people to trust him by giving them no alternative. And that might sound a bit cruel, but how else can it be done? You see, when you and I learn to do anything, ultimately the only way to gain confidence is to learn that you must have confidence. I wonder if you've ever heard the story, I'm sure you must have done, most of you, the story of how a baby eagle learns to fly. But it bears telling again, I think. There is the baby eaglet, or whatever they call it, in the eyrie, which is the nest, high up in the mountain. And when Mum Eagle decides that it's time for baby eagle to fly, Mum simply pushes baby eagle out of nest. And the eagle is dropping like a stone, because baby eagles do. They fall, just like everything else. And just before it hits the ground, having discovered that it can't do what its mother did, apparently, Mum will swoop down and catch it on its back and fly right back up again, not to take it back to the nest, but at an appropriate height to tip her wings and for the eagle to fly again, to drop like a stone again. And then Mum will do it again and pick it up and drop it again until finally, somewhere in this routine of being dropped like a stone, the baby eagle starts to flap its wings and discovers at some point in the process that it can fly. The only way it learns is to be dropped like a stone. And that's true for you and me as well. Most of us, I guess, don't know what it is to fly. But when you learn to ride a bike, you've got to discover somehow, eventually, that the only way you can learn to ride a bike is when whoever's teaching you lets go and that you can balance. Some people, of course, bash themselves even when they know already how to ride a bike, don't they? But by and large, sorry, Anna, by and large, we just have to discover things the hard way. And so on and so on. I could give multiple examples. When it comes to God, his people need to learn, more than anything else, actually not to do things without him, but the very opposite. But to simply to trust him. They need to learn faith. In fact, the most important thing in our relationship with God is that we establish this understanding and this sense that we can trust him, which is why the New Testament is full of Paul praying for people to know him better. It's not simply a head knowledge that people are that Paul's praying for them. It's a trust, a real living trust. That's the most important thing we can have about God. We've seen before, numerous times actually, as we've been through in the last few months, Genesis and now Exodus and elsewhere in the Bible, that faith is like a muscle and it grows stronger and stronger the more that it's used. And here in Exodus chapter 15, the people of God are right back to the beginning of learning afresh what God is like. We do them a disservice, you know, when we assume that these are people who have known God for a long time and that they know exactly what he's like and therefore how to deal with him. Exactly the opposite is true. We've got to understand that these people are new to faith. They're new to God. They've been slaves in Egypt. They've been in a land where people are worshipping the sun god. And all the experience of God saving them, rescuing them from slavery, and bringing them into this desert and the wilderness and so on, actually is the experience designed, says Paul in 1 Corinthians 10, which we will look at a little bit later on, to give us an example of grasping what God is like. He is revealing himself, pulling back the curtain, as it were, developing a relationship with these people as they go on. And the thing that they've got to grasp, number one, is to listen to his voice, which we saw last week, and number two is how they must trust him. But growing faith is not simple. And the first thing that we're going to see in Exodus chapter 16, I hope, is that growing faith needs problems. Growing faith needs problems. See, on one level, you would think that by now these people would understand. We've seen it multiple times in the last few weeks. Think what they've been through by the time they get to Exodus chapter 16. They've seen a God they've only vaguely heard of before doing just such astonishing things in Egypt and all the plagues and so on, which you can go back and read about in the earlier chapters. And he's seen them by, he's seen, they have seen him buy them back, redeem them, literally rescue them, and purchase them for himself in the Passover and with the death of a lamb. They've seen him lead them through the Red Sea and destroy the Egyptian army. And last week, as I've already said, we saw him test how well they would listen to his voice and not follow a God of their own imagination. There's no point in them assuming what God is like. They need to listen to know what God is like. And you'd expect them, by the time you get to chapter 16, to be asking, how much more do you need to know? If I'd been through all of that, then I wouldn't be grumbling against God and say my stomach's empty. I'd be trusting him to do. Let's just make sure that we're not too overconfident in ourselves. Before we judge them, just come back to ourselves and look at how much more of God we know than they did. These people are at a profound disadvantage to us. They don't have the gospel. They simply have, well, as much as God has revealed to them. And sure, they've got great and huge miraculous things happening, but you and I know, don't we, from experience, that actually the repeated miraculous very quickly becomes the mundane. Familiarity breeds contempt. If you've been a Christian for a while, then cast your mind back to that, particularly if you were an adult when you became a Christian, cast your mind back to that great excitement you had when you first had the Bible and you could open it up and you could say, hey, you mean to say this is actually the word of God? The God of the universe has spoken this to me? And now reflect on how you treat it now. And how keen you were to pray and to share with your friends all that God had done, and quite where it is now. We have much more than they did. And just like them, when problems arise, we have, as they did, a tendency to blame rather than to follow. That was the first problem that they encountered, actually. People say these days that we're part of a blame culture. Well, they certainly were part of a blame culture. And you see it in verse 2 of chapter 16. Let's read it together. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the Israelites said to them, if only we died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There, in Egypt, we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. You see how easy it is to forget the true picture? See, in their memory, with their stomachs empty, they're imagining themselves cozily back in Egypt, and they're sitting around the fires of their homes, and everything's delightful, and the places are awash with meat and great pots of stew on the fire, and everybody's happy together. Of course, what they're forgetting is that they had, by the time they got to these, no doubt, actually not great, but slightly empty pots of stew, they'd forgotten that they'd spent the day slaving for slave masters who had beaten them and bruised them and bashed them and crashed them, and anybody that couldn't keep up was probably put to death and whipped and scorned and so on. They weren't eating as they groaned and slaves, and their efforts building another nation's assets. They had forgotten that the grass is always greener on the other side, or so it seemed. And as far as they're concerned, it's all Moses and Aaron's fault. All Moses and Aaron's fault. Think how unlikely that was. Think how little they were considering what's going on. Did they really understand what they were saying? How could Moses and Aaron be blamed for the miraculous exodus of 2 to 3 million people from slavery in Egypt? How could Moses and Aaron be the ones whose fault it is that a Passover took place. How could Moses in particular be blamed for having opened up the Red Sea for 3 or 4 million people to walk across? And how could Moses be blamed for having kept the sea with the walls of water either side be crashing back to them? They weren't thinking straight, were they? They hadn't spotted that it was all the Lord's doing, but they didn't want to grow, they wanted to blame. They weren't after progress, they were merely after happiness, and temporary happiness at that. I think what we mustn't do, though, is say that it's wrong to ask for bread. That wasn't the problem. It's not wrong to ask for bread. In fact, in Matthew chapter 6, as part of what we call the Lord's Prayer, Jesus actually taught his people to pray as a part of what he calls the Lord's Prayer, give us today our daily bread. It's not wrong to say, Lord, I'm hungry, please can you sort that? The problem is they wanted somebody to blame. They're not interested in growing. They're not interested in changing. They're not interested in learning. They just want to blame. Some years ago, I was working near Heathrow Airport, and I remember coming on one particularly busy day to a roundabout, just somewhere near Terminal 4, if you know the area. And just as I was about to pull out onto this roundabout, I wasn't much hesitation, but I hesitated very slightly by the roundabout. And you know what I'm going to say, don't you? All of a sudden there was a bang behind me. And I heard it and I felt it. And I got out of the car, and the car behind, I'm pleased to say, hadn't bashed my bumper, had only clunked my tow bar. And he was somewhat the worse for wear. But as the driver got out, and he was a pilot with some airline or other, he looked me square in the face and he said to me, "Do you know, I don't know what's the matter with everybody," he said. "This is the third time this has happened in 3 weeks." I didn't say the obvious. But something had to change. And it wasn't the driver in front of him every time it happened, was it? The movement from finding blame to seeking solution is one that you and I have got to make if we're going to have faith that is growing. We've got to move ourselves away from finding out why we are where we are to learning to grow and to trust God for us being where we are, where we are. Growing faith needs problems if it's going to grow. And growing faith needs to see solutions from God. And the solution was graciously given to these Israelites by God, before anyone had even asked him, actually. Verse 4, then the Lord said to Moses, Moses hadn't said anything to God yet, then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way I will test them to see whether they will follow my instructions. And on the sixth day they are to prepare what they bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gather on the other days." Here's a solution, and it's God's solution, and they haven't even asked for it. But did you notice that the solution to the problem is actually a test? It's a test. He's going to give them all that they need, but they're going to have to learn through getting what they need. And they're going to have to learn to trust him. There are a couple of tests going on here. The first one, of course, is the one that God says it is. The most clear, and it's a simple test of obedience. We saw last week again, let me go back to it. How does God keep his people from idolatry? By teaching them to listen to his voice. But it's all very well listening to God's voice, providing you put it into practice. He's going to test them here by making sure that they learn obedience. Don't keep any overnight except on the Sabbath, and then don't go looking for it on the Sabbath because that's a day of rest. But there's another test that's going on here that I wonder if you've noticed. He's only going to give them enough for today. Only enough for today. Except for the day before the Sabbath, and then it's only enough for today and tomorrow. These people must learn to trust him. There's two tests in their solution, God's solution. One, to do as he says. Two, to learn to trust him. That's hard. a test of obedience and a test of reliance. Again, if you're a Christian, then I hope you're in that really good habit of thanking God for your food. It's not mandated particularly in Scripture, though it seems that that Jesus and the disciples did it. But it's good simply to remind ourselves every time we eat, and maybe at many other occasions in the day as well, that what we have is all from God. That's a healthy thing to do. Everything we have comes from Him. And most of us, I guess, are ready to acknowledge that. But I wonder sometimes if that's really at the forefront of our mind. Whether grace, as we say, saying grace, can sometimes be just something we do out of mere habit. When in reality, what we really think is it's easy to give the impression that everything comes not from God, but from the supermarket, and that the money to buy it has not come really from Him, but has been hard-earned by us. We thank God, but in the back of our minds is the suspicion that in a very general way, He hasn't really been involved. You don't believe it. That's a challenge, and it's something we need to change if it's true. But in this case, in the desert, they got that same message every day. It is God who gives you this. Every day when they went out, it was the same. No matter what else had happened, no matter how dreadfully relations with God had deteriorated, and by the time you get to the middle of the book of Numbers, they really have deteriorated, yet still God faithfully gives them, even as plagues are coming down on them, even as the ground is opening and swallowing some of them, even as there is thunder, even as there are enemies attacking them, every day God faithfully gives them, as His part of the relationship, food to eat. Every day without fail. Even in Numbers 20, where there's snakes going through the community and biting people, yet still that morning, the only way they ate was to go out and collect the manna. Every day, God gives what they need. Every day they went out, it was the same. No matter what else had happened, no matter how dreadfully rebellious they were, it was always the same. For 40 years, until in Joshua chapter 5, we find it stops when they eat the food of the promised land they've now entered. Here are people who have growing faith. Growing faith needs problems, and growing faith sees solutions from God. These are people who are learning to trust and obey. But a part of this test that He has set them by way of solution is who it is that is responsible for bringing them here. They've got to recognize what God is about. Verse 6. Moses and Aaron said to the Israelites, "In the evening you're going to know that it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt." Remember, they'd said, "It's your fault we're here starving to death." Verse 3. Moses says, "No. In the evening you're going to know that it's the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. And in the morning you'll see the glory of the Lord, because He has heard your grumbling against Him. Who are we that you should grumble against us?" Moses also said, "You will know that it was the Lord when He gives you meat to eat in the evening and all the bread you want in the morning, because He has heard your grumbling against Him. Who are we? You're not grumbling against us, but against the Lord." They've got to see that. They've got to see that grumbling about where they are is grumbling against the God they've been following, grumbling against the God they've seen at work. They have no right to do that. It's a salutary lesson, but it's a lesson that all of God's people must learn. When they criticize the message, actually they're criticizing the author of that message. Indeed, in this particular case, when they criticize the messengers who are faithfully presenting to them the message, still, they're criticizing the author of the message. Always easy to shoot the messenger, isn't it, when you hear something you don't like? Always wrong to do so. It's something that these people will have to learn the hard way. And can I say that it's something that you and I have got to learn if we're going to trust God and have growing faith? Paul writes to the Corinthian Christians in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Look it up later. Don't look it up now. And he says to them, amongst the various examples he takes from these desert wanderings of the people of God in Exodus, is this one, 1 Corinthians 10:10. Do not grumble, as some of them did. And later on, they were killed by the destroying angel. Do not grumble. God knows what he's doing. Growing faith trusts him. God's solution to their problem is to give them what they need in such a way that their faith will grow. So they had to see that this was God's doing. As they were being told of his provision, so they were shown his glory. Verse 9, again, you get it clear in the face. Moses told Aaron, say to the entire Israelite community, come before the Lord, for he's heard your grumbling. While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked towards the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. Literally, I am the I am. They couldn't blame Moses and Aaron for where they were, as they had been doing. They couldn't say, God's confused, he's walked away. They couldn't say, we haven't understood. They have to be confronted with the fact that God is God and he knows what he's doing. And they've got to trust him because they don't have any choice here. You and I are sometimes reluctant to come to that point. Often reluctant to come to that point. We like to be those who walk by sight and not by faith. They had to learn to walk by faith. What did he give them? Well, he gave them quail and he gave them manna. And both, despite what some of the commentators will tell you, both by miraculous provision. I'm quite prepared to believe, just for those of you that are interested in this, I'm quite prepared to believe that in the migration habits of the quail across the desert, God could on one occasion have blown the wind so that they had quail to eat on that particular night. Maybe on the next night, maybe on the next night, but not for 40 years long every day. I'm not prepared to believe that. Similarly, manna is a bit more difficult to describe. Quail, incidentally, are little birds that are easy to catch, just in case you're wondering about it. Manna is a bit more difficult to describe. The Israelites, they've seen it somehow. Verse 15, when the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, what is it? For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, it is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. Verse 31, they pick it up again. The people of Israel called the bread in the broadest term of provision, called the bread manna. It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. It sounds like some kind of breakfast cereal, doesn't it? The kind of thing that we might eat these days. But literally, I wonder if you've noticed, the word manna means, it's broken down into, it's two Hebrew words, man-ha, which literally means, what is it? So when confronted with this kind of coriander seed stuff, breakfast cereal every morning, they simply collected it up and said, it's the what's-its-name. That's what they called it. From then on, they ate what's-its-name for 40 years in the desert. And again, some of the commentators will tell you that it's a secretion of some kind of bug or beetle that eats the bush in the desert and then secretes this stuff, and that's why it was full of maggots and so on and so forth. I'm prepared to believe that they ate the sugary secretion of some bugs for a day or two or three, but not enough to feed millions of people every day for 40 years in the desert. God miraculously provided all they needed, and whatever they called it, it kept them going. There is an important occasion in the New Testament, actually about the same time of year, when the people of God are similarly fed by a miracle. Turn with me to John chapter 6, can you? Page 752, if you're using one of the Bibles from the table at the back. And there at the beginning of John chapter 6 comes this amazing occasion where about the Passover time of year, you can tell that because the grass is green, Jesus takes 5 loaves and 2 little fish and feeds between 5 and 15,000 people with it. Pick up Jesus' account of what happens in verse 32 of John chapter 6, page 753. Jesus said to them, "I tell you the truth, it is not Moses who has given you bread from heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world."
"Sir," they said, "from now on give us this bread."
Then Jesus declared, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and he who believes in me will never be thirsty." Jump across to verse 41. At this the Jews began to grumble about him because he said, "I am the bread that came down from heaven." They said, "Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he say, 'I came down from heaven'?" "Stop grumbling among yourselves," Jesus answered, verse 43. Jump to verse 47. "I tell you the truth, he who believes has everlasting life. I am the bread of life. Your forefathers ate manna in the desert, yet they died. But here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which a man may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world." Let's be clear. He's not talking about communion. He's talking here about the cross. And it's vital to rely on what he has done. We have no choice. That's what God is teaching these people in the desert in Israel, or in the desert on their way to Israel all that time ago. In order to have any kind of relationship with God, they've got to trust him. Growing faith needs problems, and growing faith sees solutions. This is the fundamental point of the gospel, isn't it? Abraham, we read in Genesis chapter 15, believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. We must believe God in order to have any kind of relationship with him at all. These people have a faith that is growing so that they will believe God and trust in him and him alone. The people in Jesus' day needed to trust in him and him alone. You and I need to trust in him and him alone. There's an old hymn. I thought none of the modern hymn books would have it. I've discovered it in one of them. We may sing it at some point. It's a wonderful old hymn. And the first verse and the chorus say, "My faith has found a resting place, not in device or creed. I trust the ever-living one. His wounds for me shall plead. I need no other argument. I need no other plea. It is enough that Jesus died, and that he died for me." Growing faith trusts God's solution. That's what we must do as well. And the final point, back to Exodus chapter 16. How did they do? Well, actually, the truth is growing faith grows slowly. Some of them neither believed nor trusted, but they found their self-reliance useless. Verse 19, "Then Moses said to them, 'No one is to keep any of it till morning.' However, some of them paid no attention to Moses, and they kept part of it till morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Each morning everyone gathered as much as he needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. They started well and went flat on their face." And God graciously gave them another chance. They found their self-reliance useless. How often do we need to be reminded that we cannot save ourselves? How often does the devil whisper in your ear, "Look, if you're a Christian, you're not really that good a Christian, and God's not really going to provide all that you need, and he's not really going to save you from your sin and take you to heaven, because you missed your quiet time last week, didn't you? In fact, you haven't had a quiet time for 3 weeks running. In fact, going to church sometimes is a bore. In fact..." No, I hope that's never true, by the way. How often do we need to be reminded we cannot save ourselves but have to trust in Jesus? Some of them found their self-reliance useless. And some of them had to learn obedience all over again. Verse 27, nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long will you, and that's plural, refuse to keep my commands and my instructions? They needed to hear all over again what God had said and pick themselves up and do it again. You and I have that same experience all the time, don't we? That we just somehow find it so difficult to do what God says, and that's exactly what we have to do if we're going to know what it is to be blessed. How often do we need simply to go back to doing what the Bible says? And all of them had to remember. Verse 33, Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it, and then place it before the Lord to be kept for the generations to come. And it says that's exactly what he did. They didn't have the testimony when this first occurred, but by the end of the book they had the Ark of the Testimony, and presumably that's what they're referring to in verse 34. They had to remember that God had provided all that they needed. Growing faith means we have to remember that God has provided all that we needed to save us from our sin, to carry on to take us to heaven. And we need to learn to trust him through thick and thin, through up and down, and always in what Jesus has done. Growing faith needs problems. Growing faith needs to see God's solutions. And growing faith grows slowly, but it must grow. And that's what we need to set ourselves out for.